From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up on this Monday edition, the lawlessness continued over the weekend on the streets of major left-leaning cities as federal buildings were attacked, as protesters squared off with federal law enforcement officials once again. However, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, New York's Jerry Nadler, says the violence in Portland is all a myth. We'll talk with a Daily Caller reporter, Jorge Ventura, who has been on the ground in Portland about that myth in just a moment. The U.S. Supreme Court late Friday essentially communicated that the governor of Nevada was okay in favoring casinos over constitutionally protected churches in the state's coronavirus restrictions. The 5-4 decision, with Chief Justice John Roberts again providing the fifth vote for the liberal majority, allows the state to keep in place more onerous restrictions on churches than casinos, restaurants, and amusement parks. Justice Kavanaugh, in his dissent, wrote very succinctly, quote, "Nevada is discriminating against religion," end quote. Well, are such decisions by the court undermining the rule of law in our country and fueling government distrust? Will the court, once again, be an issue in this November's election? We'll talk about it later here on Washington Watch. We'll also be joined by attorneys with Alliance Defending Freedom who are representing the church in Nevada that have challenged the state's meeting restrictions on churches as being unconstitutional. What are the next steps for churches in Nevada and elsewhere? David Cortman joins us later here on Washington Watch. And speaking of the court, Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said it is time for the guessing game to end when it comes to Supreme Court nominees. Hawley said in a Washington Post interview over the weekend that when it comes to Roe v. Wade, that the nominees' records need to be established because the case has become so central to representing a justice's judicial philosophy. So what is he prepared to do to end the guessing game? He joins us a little bit later here on Washington Watch. Also, David Clawson will join me for a discussion about, is it time for those states that have breached the line and continue to violate the Constitution, is it time for churches to decide for themselves whether or not they will meet? We'll talk about it later here on Washington Watch. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter or Parler, it is at T Perkins. And let me just say thanks to Sarah for filling in for me for the last week or so. I got the Chinese present. I got the coronavirus, and so now fully recovered, back in the chair behind the microphone and glad to be so. But I've been tracking it and appreciate Sarah filling in for me. Again, the website, TonyPerkins.com. If you miss anything on your way home, you can find it there a little bit later. All right, we're getting reports out of Portland and other places over the weekend. The violence continues. But I've got a clip. This is the House Judiciary Committee chairman, pretty important role, Jerry Nadler of New York. He was asked by some people on the street, activists, if you will, about the Antifa-inspired violence in Portland. Here's the interaction that took place with Congressman Nadler.
You disavow the violence from Antifa that's happening in Portland right now? There's riots?
That's a myth that's being spread only in Washington, D.C.
He was asked if he disavowed the violence being inspired by Antifa in Portland, and he said, that's a myth only being circulated here in Washington, D.C. Joining me now to talk about what is actually happening on the ground in Portland is Jorge Ventura. He is a reporter with Daily Caller. Jorge, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Tony.
All right, so let me just put it to you very straightforward. Is what's happening, what we're hearing about the violence for now almost 60 days taking place in Portland, a myth?
It's absolutely not, and I was very shocked and disappointed to actually hear those comments coming out of Jerry Nadler, because speaking to Portland residents, they are tired of the constant violence and clashes between the federal officers and just huge crowd here in Portland that's on a nightly basis. Last night, it reached 60 nights. On my second week here on the ground, I interviewed a veteran, actually, who told me that it actually reminds him of his time in Iraq. That's how bad it got here. But to hear that it's a myth, it was shocking. I mean, an Antifa member actually stabbed a black Trump supporter on Friday night. So, I mean, I was just shocked to hear that.
So, Jorge, give our listeners a little sense of what you're seeing when we're hearing about, you know, the federal officers that are protecting federal property, the building, the courthouse there in Portland, that is the target of these massive crowds. I mean, over the weekend, reached to 4,000 people that converged upon the courthouse, trying to break through the fence, the barrier, throwing objects, firing fireworks, all types of it. Describe what's taking place.
Well, Tony, I've been covering protests all across the country, and I've never seen anything like we're seeing here in downtown Portland. These groups are very well organized. They have medic teams. They actually have their own kitchen called Riot Ribs across the park that feeds these protesters and actually supplies them with shields and eyewear and other things they need to be out here. It's just, I've never seen anything like it. And also the weaponry from these protesters, we're talking about mortars, fireworks, hammers, all types of, you know, things that we've actually never seen on the ground. On Friday, it was actually reported that 6 federal officers were injured due to the mortar blast and fireworks, and one federal officer actually had to be hospitalized. We're also seeing the protesters bring these high-pointed lasers, and they're actually pointed into the federal officers' eyes. A report came last week that at least 3 federal officers could be permanently blinded due to this. So just what we've been seeing is these protesters every night bringing all these types of weapons. We've been seeing the past few days, we saw some power tools being used on the high-graded fence. They were trying to chop a little hole in the fence guarding the federal courthouse. So we've seen all types of things here. And like I said, I've covered protests all across the country. I've just never seen the organization level that we're seeing here in Portland.
So, Jorge, let me ask you about that. If this organization, the material that is being supplied to these protesters, being able to sustain this protest, what's behind it? As a reporter, what have you? Is this organic, or is there something behind that's helping organize and sustain this protest?
So a couple of things that we are seeing is these Antifa groups are taking in money and donations online, and we feel like this money is going into helping them supply this, especially for people who are sympathetic to the BLM movement. They feel like Antifa is part of their message. So folks are supplying money through online. One thing that we've been noticing here is that members of Antifa have been driving up to the parks with all types of things. We've been seeing gas masks delivered here, eyewear, bats, shields, you name it. They've been able to supply it here from Portland. One thing we've noticed too is a lot of these folks here are not from Portland, so we have people now coming from out of town into the city. And a lot of the folks actually I'm meeting here on the ground are coming in from Seattle, which is we're finding very interesting. But this is coming in from online donations, and the bigger members of the Antifa group are bringing in these types of weapons into the riots. Last night we saw actually a box of rocks just on the ground randomly in front of the federal courthouse. We found that very odd. So we're seeing those types of strange things throughout the night here in Portland, just covering these riots.
Now, clearly that explains the financing, the online financing, those that want to fuel the work of Antifa. But the organization would suggest training and preparation. Any idea where that is coming from?
We haven't been able to find exactly how they're getting prepared and trained. The thing is, these groups have done they do a really good job of keeping their communication very low-key when it comes to their communications on social media. One thing that we picked up here is there's an app called Signal, which is an encryption message app. So this is where a lot of the Antifa are communicating. This is where, you know, a lot of their organization and meetup is coming from. So that's one thing that we are also still on the ground trying to work on, and just seeing where this is coming from. What is anyone training these people? Are there, you know, tactics that these groups are using? That's something that we're still on the ground trying to find out. This is a very dangerous group as well to be reporting on. For us here at the Daily Caller, we have to come into most of these situations dressed undercover, because these groups monitor our social media networks. They try to track us where we are, and that makes our job just a little bit more dangerous than the usual.
Well, that was on my list of questions, Jorge, to ask you as a reporter and one that is not, you know, I mean, you just call balls and strikes. You're not necessarily sympathetic to what they're doing there, which is the kind of media they like, which is most of the media. Are you fearful? Are you concerned for your own safety there?
Well, yes, Tony, we've been basically hunted down and targeted by this group. And not only here in Portland, our reporting in D.C., we've been confronted actually a couple times from these groups. So for us, for safety, to protect the reporters, we go in undercover. We try not to disclose the locations we'll be reporting at beforehand. That was something that we like to do, is say, hey, guys, we're heading into this location. What questions would you like to ask? That's something that we've taken out. We also have to be careful when we do live stream. One thing that we like at the Daily Caller is we like to live stream for our audience so they could check out the event for themselves, see the mood. But that's something that we have to kind of take out the game for now, just because the Antifa groups monitor our social networks. They try to hunt us down where we are, and they also try to dock us. So if they find out what we're wearing, they'll try to take pictures of us. You then put that on Twitter and blast that out online and basically tell people to hunt us down and steal our phones if they have a chance. So we've been really just trying to play it safe, going undercover, and, thank God so far we haven't had any major issues just yet here in Portland.
So there is a deliberate effort to try to have a biased perspective of what is happening there with the riots. They do not want reporters who would actually show the violence, the organization, and what is really happening on the ground.
Yes, correct. I actually was speaking to someone. I call it a media war what we're having in Portland. Here in Portland, they have a bunch of independent, even the local journalists here, left-leaning, who have been uploading videos and content to Twitter, who have only been showing one side of a story. They only show the side when the federal officers respond, and they've been trying to make bad. And we've been seeing that type of footage on MSNBC, CNN, New York Times just put out a piece basically putting the blame on Trump and the federal administration. But what we've been seeing here on the ground is that's just really not the case. The crowd attacks the federal courthouse. They throw mortars and fireworks, and we're seeing arson. I mean, we're seeing fires started on a federal courthouse property, and that usually draws out the response from the federal officers. So the whole story really hasn't even been playing out in the media due to the kind of media war we're actually seeing here in downtown Portland.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. As a former police officer, I know how a snippet of a video can be captured that does not tell the whole story, but it certainly will paint a picture that is helpful to those that are trying to undermine law enforcement. Jorge, very quickly, we're almost out of time, but a Washington Times report said that Molotov cocktails, rifle ammunition was found found near the Portland protest. Have you seen any weapons, guns?
Yeah, Tony, so we have been seeing some individuals here armed, and yesterday, actually last night, reporting on 960 was the first night that we've seen those cocktails actually in person. Elijah Schaefer, a reporter yesterday, was able to capture video footage of cocktails being thrown, those Molotovs, into the federal courthouse. And the day before, if your audience wants, they could go on the Portland Police Twitter. And Portland Police Twitter actually put the photograph of the ammunition clips and the cocktails there for the photo evidence. So very shocking stuff to see that type of stuff here in Portland, and we'll continue to provide those updates.
Well, Jorge, I want to thank you for joining us, and we definitely will check back with you.
Thanks for having me on, Tony.
All right, Jorge Ventura with The Daily Caller. Yeah, so much for the myth there, Mr. Nadler. All right, when we come back, the court on Friday saying that casinos have more of a right to meet and gather in Nevada than churches. Maybe if churches put slot machines in their foyers, they would have greater protections in Nevada. Well, we're going to be talking with Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who says the guessing game over where nominees stand on critical issues must end. He tells us about it next. Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Absent fathers, distracted fathers, and angry fathers have created a vacuum of the soul in the lives of many children. Pornography is epidemic, affecting the male brain, isolating his heart, and degrading women who long to be cherished. Confusion and even skepticism about marriage run rampant, especially in our younger generations. Selfishness among men has led to broken homes and a trail littered with broken hearts, including their own. Where can you turn to find the solutions to these problems? Leadership in Love, A Tale of Two Fathers, is a new publication from Family Research Council that takes a look at two men, Joshua and the father of the prodigal son, as strong examples of leadership and love. It also weaves in an understanding of attachment science to underscore the needs of children, which need to be met to become emotionally healthy and spiritually strong. Visit frc.org/fathers to learn more.
In today's culture, it can be difficult for men to navigate what it means to be a man and to find clear models of masculinity and manhood. There are many competing ideas out there and even confusion around the basic concepts of gender and sex. Where can boys, young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of manhood, leadership, and strength in today's culture of confusion? This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join me at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference led by men who are seasoned, compassionate leaders who understand the issues of the day. These issues will invest in unpacking our role as defenders, providers, instructors, and battle buddies so that men can have generational influence as a chaplain inside and outside the home. Join us at one of our upcoming events in Texas, Louisiana, Florida, or Virginia. Learn more about Stand Courageous and find an event near you at StandCourageous.com. That's StandCourageous.com. StandCourageous.com. Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins, the website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, we were just talking about the protest in Portland. I should say the myth of the protest and violence in Portland in the world, according to Jerry Nadler. But tomorrow we're going to look at the real agenda behind the Black Lives Matter. We're going to talk about that. But for today, I want to know what you are thinking. In fact, I need your help on this one. It's a poll question, but it's an important one. And you can text the word radio to 53445. Again, that number is 53445. Text the word radio, and I'll send you a link to take the poll question. Here's the question. And again, this is an important one I need your help on. I need to take time to participate in this one. As violent and lawless protesters are working to turn America toward a Marxist country, will you join a protest for America and commit to pray for our nation, vote in November, and stand for the truth? Will you do that? I need to know. Because unless you vote and you commit to vote and you pray for this nation and you're willing to stand up for the truth in this environment where people are canceled for speaking truth, I mean, if you're not willing to stand up as someone who loves America, loves God, country, and family, folks, the outcome's not going to be too good. So again, I need to hear from you on this. Text the word radio to 53445. All right, speaking of lawlessness, the U.S. Supreme Court late Friday essentially communicated that Governor of Nevada, Steve Sisolak, was okay in his policies favoring casinos over constitutionally protected churches in the state's coronavirus restrictions. The 5-4 decision allows the state to keep in place more onerous restrictions on churches than casinos, restaurants, and indoor amusement parks. Now, Justice Kavanaugh, in his dissent, wrote very succinctly, and I think clearly, quote, Nevada is discriminating against religion, end quote. So are such decisions by the court undermining the rule of law and fueling government distrust in our country? Join me now to talk about this and about the ending the guessing game of a Supreme Court nominee's judicial philosophy is Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee and the former Attorney General of the State of Missouri. Senator, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me.
I would just put this before you. Are we not in trouble when the Supreme Court cannot distinguish between a constitutionally protected right exercise, free exercise of religion, and the ability to go in and play slot machines. If we can't distinguish between those two, I would suggest we're in trouble.
Big trouble. Big trouble. And not only because, Tony, this disparate treatment is a problem, but the truth is the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States gives churches and the right to worship a special status. I mean, it's bad enough that churches in Nevada and elsewhere are being treated as second-class institutions and treated worse than liquor stores or gambling halls or casinos or whatever else. That's bad enough. But, in fact, the Constitution gives them a special protected status, and this court is so far from recognizing that. This decision on Friday is really a travesty. It is totally unjustifiable, and I think it's quite significant that the majority was silent. They didn't write. I'd love to see them try to explain this outrageous decision.
You know, I'm not surprised at the order from Governor Sisolak, because when you look at Nevada, they generate over a third of their state's budget comes from casino revenue. About $1.5 billion annually comes from casinos, and they do not generate any monetary value over churches, although I would argue that the value of the churches being active is much more important to the overall climate and stability of the state. But for the Supreme Court, I mean, their focus is on the Constitution. That's it. That's all they need to do. And in this case, they took a pass allowing these stringent regulations on churches to remain intact. And I go back to what I opened with, Senator Hawley, because you've been an outspoken defender of the Constitution. But when we have a country that is ruled by law, the Constitution being that rule of law, and that's undermined by the court, what we see is government is undermining its own authority, and people begin to distrust government more and more.
Well, in this case, Tony, I think it's even worse than taking a pass. What the court did on Friday is they endorsed, a majority of the court endorsed, this discriminatory set of practices by Nevada. It's also happening in California. It's happening in a number of states across the country where churches are being singled out for disfavor. I mean, once again, in Nevada, you can have casinos, including, by the way, the casinos convention center, their stage and arena area. Those can all be filled at 50% capacity, which could be hundreds and hundreds, I don't know, maybe thousands of people. Yet churches are limited to 50 total congregants, no matter what the size of their building is. It's just, this is discrimination, pure and simple. It has gone on for too long. I've asked the Justice Department to open a civil rights investigation into this issue and into every state that is practicing this form of discrimination. But we should not lose sight of the fact the United States Supreme Court is falling down on its constitutional responsibilities here. And I have to say, this is really of a piece with what we have seen from this court. The imperial judiciary lives, Tony. It is alive and well, and that this Supreme Court is as imperial a court as we have ever had.
But does this not undermine the rule of law in our country when we can't even go by the very words that are in the Constitution?
It absolutely does undermine the rule of law. Basic tenet of the rule of law is that citizens are supposed to, A, be the lawmakers, either directly or through their elected representatives. B, everybody is supposed to know what the law says and is. In this case, we've got elected officials in some states who are disregarding the laws of probably their states and certainly of the United States Constitution. And we have a United States Supreme Court that thinks that it's a super legislature, that it can just make up the law as it goes along, or in this case, bless and condone the unconstitutional acts of state officials. And who's to say, Tony? I mean, the way that the Supreme Court has treated these church cases, we'll just have to find out in a later case what the rules are. I mean, they change with the case. Who knows? So this is antithetical to the rule of law. It's very dangerous.
Well, and when we come back from this break, we're up against a break, we're going to talk about a remedy that you have put forth when it comes to the judicial philosophy of Supreme Court nominees. You've basically said over the weekend the guessing game has to end. And we're going to talk about that on the other side of the break. Folks, don't go away. Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, joins us next to talk about ending this guessing game. It's kind of like you never know what you're going to get when a Republican nominates a Supreme Court justice. He has a remedy. We talk about it next here on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
Do Christians have a biblical obligation to participate in government? Do Christians have a duty to vote? And if so, what principles should inform them while casting their ballots? How should pastors think about politics, and how can they shepherd their congregations well during an election season? The gospel of Jesus Christ has implications for all areas of our life, including politics. Christians must be prepared to grapple with the moral issues of our day, the reality of our two-party system, and follow our Christian convictions to their logical end by voting for candidates that support clear biblical values. Family Research Council has partnered with 21 state family policy councils for a new edition of Biblical Principles for Political Engagement. This booklet provides biblical wisdom and clear answers to pivotal questions to help you navigate the political landscape. This publication exists to facilitate careful thinking about issues and encourage God-honoring political engagement that filters all issues and candidates through a biblical worldview. To read the full publication, visit frc.org/engage.
Not so long ago, sex education in public schools involved learning about human growth and development and listening to advice on how to be careful, respect others, and save sex for marriage. Things are very different today. Parents have two main concerns about sex ed: that it sexualizes children and that it's loaded with LGBTQ indoctrination. Family Research Council has released a new resource to address this issue titled Sex Education in Public Schools: Sexualization of Children and LGBT Indoctrination. This resource reveals troubling examples of the agenda-driven content being pushed in modern sex ed and exposes the powerful organizations behind it all. Finally, it offers some action steps for parents to consider in their fight to protect the health and innocence of their children. For more information about sex education in public schools and to view this resource, visit frc.org/sexeducation. That's frc.org/sexeducation.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us on this Monday afternoon. Again, I need to hear from you on today's poll question. Text the word radio to 53445. 53445. I'll send you a link. As violent and lawless protesters are working to turn America toward a Marxist country, will you join the protest for America and commit to pray for our nation, vote in November, and stand for the truth? Text the word radio to 53445. Need to hear from you. All right. Over the weekend, a Washington Post story, an interview with our guest that is joining us right now, Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has made some waves. And I would say it's about time. For far too long, as the senator has articulated, conservatives have sat back in the corner and been quiet and been content to take promises that have never been fulfilled. Not any longer. He said, I will vote only for those Supreme Court nominees who have explicitly acknowledged that Roe v. Wade is wrongly decided, meaning that they have been on the record before they were nominated about the case. Senator, those are pretty strong words and have drawn quite a reaction.
Well, it's time, Tony, that we ask the question that is fundamental to a judge's judicial philosophy. And Roe was an unbridled act of judicial imperialism. It's also a moral outrage. It's one of the worst decisions ever handed down by the United States Supreme Court. It's completely lawless. It belongs with Dred Scott and Plessy versus Ferguson as decisions that have wounded the soul of this nation and that are completely without justification in the Constitution of the United States. And I want to know from any individual, judge or whatever, nominated to the United States Supreme Court, whether they are able to recognize the illegitimate nature of Roe versus Wade as a constitutional matter. And I want to see it in the record. I don't want private assurances. I don't want personal predictions about what they might do in the future. I want to see record evidence that as a matter of law, they recognize that Roe versus Wade is wrongly decided. If that's not there, if that evidence is not there, I will not vote for them.
Senator, I applaud that position because we have, in my almost 20 years of being in this position, we've had to oppose Republican nominees because we were told, no, no, they're going to be good. They're going to be good. How can you tell me? Well, we just know, even though they had, in some cases, a paper trail that suggested they were not good. And we've even seen on the present court with the Chief Justice, where he has lined up repeatedly with the court's liberal now majority of five justices. This is a fundamental issue. The issue of the sanctity of human life, this created from the shadows of the Constitution. And you're absolutely right. If you don't get this right, it's very unlikely you're going to end up in the right place on other issues.
You know, Roe really is a symbol of judicial imperialism. Roe is the point at which the modern Supreme Court, back in 1973, the modern Supreme Court said, we're not even going to attempt to follow the Constitution. And there's a famous line by the late liberal constitutional scholar John Hart Ely. He was a Democrat, political liberal, and he said this about Roe. He said, it's not constitutional law, and it gives almost no sense of an obligation to try to be. And that's exactly right, which is why a judge's position on Roe, the understanding of that case as a legal matter, sheds great light. It is a window onto their constitutional worldview. And the simple fact of the matter is, if you can't recognize that Roe was wrong constitutionally, then you are a judicial imperialist. And that's going to have consequences across a range of cases. Yeah. It's a basic matter of constitutional fidelity.
So, Senator Hawley, I want to talk about the practical practical implications of this position that you've stated, which, again, I applaud. But there are 12 Republican members of the committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, through which all nominees, judicial nominees, must pass. There are 10 Democrats. If you do not support a nominee and all the Democrats oppose them, that becomes 11-11, which would mean that the nomination, if I understand it correctly, would not succeed. It would die because it did not get an affirmative vote. So this, for the first time, actually puts conservatives in a position to influence the nominees that are put forth before the committee.
This, I hope, will be a signal that I'm very serious about it. And you're right about the vote counting. And, of course, who knows what the votes of the Judiciary Committee will be in years to come. But right now, one Republican no vote would mean that, at least at the very least, Tony, a nominee could not be recommended to the floor with a positive recommendation for the Judiciary Committee. But I think it is important to make your position here clear. Other senators have made their position clear with regard to Roe and on other issues. And I think it's important that those of us who believe in fidelity to the Constitution and who also believe that Roe is a moral travesty as well as a constitutional travesty, that we make our position clear and insist that, you know, no, Roe is not some secondary matter. It is central to a judge's philosophy. So I'm just saying, it's not my job to choose the judges or the justices to be nominated. I only have one role in this process, that is to vote to confirm or not. And I'm just saying that I will not vote to confirm if a judge nominated for the Supreme Court has not acknowledged Roe is wrongly decided.
Well, again, Senator Hawley, I commend you because for far too long, conservatives have been silent while the moderates have spoken up and driven the process and the type of nominees that have been put forward. And I'm with you. I am 100% with you in the position that you've articulated, and we're grateful for you standing up for the Constitution and for the unborn. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. All right, folks, don't go away. David Cortman, attorney with Alliance Defending Freedom, who argued on behalf of the church in Nevada, joins us next with the latest on this case and where it might go next. Don't go away.
Could you use some timely and original commentary to read this summer, specifically on the issues facing our culture today? FRCblog.com has just what you're looking for. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts, members of the Family Research Council team, as well as outside contributors. You can learn about religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture. Check out this list of a few of our most recent titles. What does it mean to be a woman? D.C. Christians take to the streets to sing, lament, and pray, and prayerfully responding to civil unrest. At Family Research Council, our mission is to advance faith, family, and freedom in the culture by helping you to live out your faith and stand for truth. Our blog helps you do just that. Stay informed and get the resources you need at frcblog.com. On April 16th, President Trump and the White House Coronavirus Task Force announced a three-phase plan with guidelines for how states can begin scaling back restrictions. Churches should begin putting in place plans to reopen and operate their ministries according to the guidance of the Centers for Disease Control as state officials begin lifting orders. Here at Family Research Council, we have summarized the White House three-phase plan and how it relates to in-person church meetings and gatherings. Check out our resource, What Pastors Should Know About the White House Plan to Open Up America Again. Our resource offers practical guidelines for how churches and houses of worship can begin to operate safely as our country reopens. Visit frc.org/church guidelines to view this resource and learn more. There, you'll also find our full list of resources for churches in the time of coronavirus. Again, that's frc.org/church guidelines.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Hannah.
What's going on? Why so gloomy?
Well, I'm a little disappointed. I had a lot planned to do during the stay-at-home time, and I just didn't do it.
Oh, yeah? What did you have planned that you didn't get to do?
Well, I was actually hoping I would finally be able to get time to do a regular Bible reading routine, and I started a couple of times. I just didn't stick with it.
Don't be too down on yourself. Starting a new routine can be hard, but one way to help is to join in with others and to have a good game plan. I think I have a good solution for you.
Oh, yeah?
Tony Perkins and FRC are doing a 2-year study in the Word. They have it all mapped out.
When did they start? I would be so far behind.
Oh, that's not a problem. You can literally jump in anytime. There's a daily reading, just a couple of chapters a day, with questions to help you think about what you're reading.
Nice. Where can I find this?
Go to frc.org/Bible, and you can get started.
Where's that again?
frc.org/Bible.
Got it. Checking it out now.
This is Washington Watch, and I'm Tony Perkins. The website, TonyPerkins.com. Hey, let me again give out the number that you can text so you can participate in this poll question. I'd really like to hear from you on this one. Text the word radio to 53445. Number 53445, the word radio. I'll send you a link to take the poll. Here's the question. As violent and lawless protesters are working to turn America toward a Marxist country, will you join a protest for America and commit to pray for our nation, vote in November, and stand for the truth? It's the only hope for our nation. All right, on Friday, we were talking about this with Senator Josh Hawley. The court, late on Friday, by a 5-4 decision, declined to halt the enforcement of Nevada Governor Steve Sisolak's discriminatory restrictions on churches that he put in place in response to the coronavirus. Now, what is at stake here is that casinos, restaurants, bars, indoor theme parks, and gyms can operate at 50% capacity, meaning, according to the fire marshal says 1,000 people is the limit. They can have 500, according to this order. Churches, however, churches, regardless of the size, it could be a church that seats 2,500. It could be a church that seats 10,000. They can only have 50 or fewer people. Joining me now to talk about this is the Freedom Alliance Defending Freedom Senior Counsel, David Cortman, who is handling this case for the Calvary Chapel Church there in Nevada. David, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, good to be on again.
So, David, your initial reaction, obviously disappointed that the court did not step in here. So what do you make of their rationale?
Yeah, disappointed and a little bit surprised. I think, you know, it comes down to the chief. In an earlier opinion, he wrote a short opinion of why he didn't take the previous case. But basically, I think his rationale is that it's difficult relief when you are up on what's called an emergency appeal. You're just moving through the system because of how important it is for churches to be able to meet. And every Sunday that goes by is a violation of their rights. But when you go that fast, the court tends to hesitate a little bit and say, wait a minute, you're kind of taking this too quickly. Let's slow it down. Our hope is, and we obviously don't agree with his opinion not to take it, but our hope is with the other four dissenting justices that when we get back up there, which we will under these facts, that this to me should be a 9-0 opinion. It shouldn't be left versus right. You know, it shouldn't be Republican versus Democrat. It shouldn't matter. If you allow casinos to meet in the thousands, but you will limit the church to 50, that is such a clear constitutional violation. It would seem like all the justices should be on board.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's clearly written in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, First Amendment, free exercise, but nowhere in the Constitution do you find the right to pull the arm of a slot machine. And here you see casinos, and some of the points that are in these dissents are very good, as you point out. When you look at Alito pointed out that, you know, casinos are permitted to serve alcohol, which is well known to induce risk-taking, and drinking generally requires at least a temporary removal of mask. He does that, juxtaposing that to the strict guidelines that the church had in place to protect congregants who come from any spread of a virus.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite remarkable, especially because in the record we have pictures of folks when the casinos opened up and there are thousands of people waiting to get in. The governor flew people in from all different states, which obviously is a concern, encourage people to go there. Nobody's wearing masks. They're not distanced. You know, some of these casinos are, you know, 20,000, 30,000 square feet. You're talking about thousands of people here, but yet for some reason – people who go to church who are sitting still with their family, socially distanced from everybody else, not moving, you know, can only have a limit of 50 people. It's just really incredible that the court let this go, but we're hoping that won't last for long.
So, David Cortman, I've got to ask you this question from a standpoint of having been in the legislature in Louisiana when gambling came in and the addictive nature of the revenue from gambling. When you look at Nevada's state budget, where, they're bumping up to 40% of the state's revenue, total tax revenue, comes from gambling, about $1.5 billion. And, of course, they're not making money off of churches because churches are tax exempt for the most part. Is this a monetary decision in the minds of the governor there in Nevada?
Yeah, I think it is. And even in the briefing, they admitted that and said, well, you know, our economy is important. And I think that's the rub. First of all, you mentioned before, you actually have a constitutional right, you know, to free exercise of religion, no constitutional right to gamble. Setting that aside, it's valuing the mighty dollar. It's valuing the economy over someone's spirituality. And I think that is really where the case comes down to. And the court has said in the past, you can't diminish and treat worse religious freedoms than you do other types of reasoning. And that's exactly what the state has done in this case.
And why this case is so important that ultimately it is decided correctly. Because if we allow public policy to be made solely on the value of a dollar and what comes into state coffers, as opposed to what is protected under the Constitution, we will be in deep trouble as a nation.
Yeah, I think that's right. And not only for the obvious reason that you're diminishing the constitutional rights. And people need to understand, this is not just to protect religious folks. The religious freedoms that we have protect everyone, whether you're religious or not. And so if you say, well, it really doesn't matter, it does, because if you allow the government to take the economy or to take money and say that's more important than people's free speech or free exercise of religion, right, then what you're doing is diminishing all of our rights.
Absolutely, without question. So, David Cortman, what's next in this case, and when do you think it could be back before the Supreme Court?
Yeah, so right now we are in the middle of briefing the case at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals right below the court. We're going through the briefing process, and then we'll get a ruling for them. And then hopefully we'll be back up in the next couple months to the Supreme Court, and hopefully this time they'll take a look at the record and rule what we think is the right way, and that's on behalf of the church.
Will this advance, even, let's say, if the governor pulls back a month and a half from now before you're able to get to the Supreme Court, will the case go forward because of the underlying question that exists in this case?
Well, it really depends on what the next order is and when. You know, we've seen this order has already been in place for over 4 months. And so even though there's been adjustments as we go, there's been no adjustment to the churches. So I would be surprised if the governor let up at all. As you mentioned before, looking at commercial activities and the money, that's the issue here. So I'd expect this issue still to be around for the next couple of months.
All right, David Kortman, we're grateful for the work that Alliance Defending Freedom does, and we'll be watching this case very, very, very closely. Thanks so much for joining us.
All right, thank you. Appreciate everything you do.
All right, David Kortman, Senior Counsel for Alliance Defending Freedom, and this is a big case, a very significant case, because for all the reasons we just laid out, and that you have... You know, and they're not hiding the fact that they're favoring the casinos because of the monetary gain that the state drives from gambling. Almost 40% of the state's budget. While a constitutionally protected act is being heavily restricted. And you can read some of these dissents from the Supreme Court, from the four justices who dissented. But I want to explore this a little bit further, because this is something we've been talking about now for a number of months, about obeying the direction of government when it comes to churches and meeting. And you know, for those that have been listening for any amount of time, know that I was very supportive, you know, in the initial phases of this, of, hey, well, let's do our part, because everyone was asked to shut down. Businesses were shut down. Restaurants were shut down. But now we're beginning to see this discriminatory treatment toward churches. And many churches now are having to answer the question, who do we obey? Do we obey government when, you know, these laws and the application of these rules are unjust? Scripture says, Jesus said, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's? Well, in our country, and I was talking about this earlier, and this is a point I was making with Senator Hawley, we are a nation ruled by law. We're not ruled by a king. We're not ruled by a president. We're not ruled by a Congress. We're not ruled by a court. We're ruled by law. That's the Constitution and the laws that are built upon that Constitution. And so when that is breached, and of course, we're the ones that, as Josh Hawley said, we elect the leaders who make the laws. But when you have courts and you have dictators like the governor there in Nevada that breached the Constitution, it undermines the rule of law in our country. So what are churches to do? Well, join me now to talk more about this, David Clawson, here in the Family Research Council, our biblical worldview. David, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, great to be with you, Tony.
Look, I know firsthand that many pastors are wrestling with this, because I've had the conversations with them. I've had conversations with pastors in Nevada. I've had conversations with pastors in California, in particular, those two states where you have governors that are treating the churches differently in a more discriminatory fashion, quite frankly, because I don't think they want the churches to meet. So from a biblical perspective, how would we, or how should we, approach this dilemma?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I encourage all of our listeners to read the dissents, especially Neil Gorsuch's. You know, he makes the memorable point that the Constitution does not permit the state to favor Caesar's Palace over Calvary Chapel, which is the church in question. But you're getting at something that is really important. I do want to make a broader kind of theological point, and it needs to be said, you know, churches and Christians at large are not— we're at large not trying to be belligerent or obstinate or trying to cause trouble. You know, the pastors right. that I yeah. talk to every day, they want to honor the governing authorities. They want to be obedient to Romans 13, but they also want to honor the Lord Jesus Christ, who is the head of the church. And so the problem comes when you have mayors and governors that are, let's just call it for what it is, discriminating against churches and houses of worship. And when that's happening, I think we do need to make the broader theological point that when that's taking place, some of these orders probably shouldn't be followed, because although we want to honor the authorities, those authorities need to be reminded of their proper jurisdiction, which is not regulating worship or determining questions of ecclesiology.
And David, historically, when, you know, let's go back to the very beginning of the church, where the disciples, Peter, John, and others were told not to preach in the name of Jesus in Acts. And they chose to continue to teach in the name of Jesus, despite the order from those in authority, but they also stood prepared to pay the consequences. So we realize that, you know, sometimes we stand up, and in fact, in our system of government, you have to really kind of challenge an unjust law to get that law or that order before the court, in many cases, to get it struck down. And so there are consequences, but I think we have to be willing to pay those. Now, I want to go back to what you said at the beginning. I think that's an extremely important point, is that this is not about churches who want to be belligerent. Those who, you know, when the first wave of this came out, nobody really knew what we were dealing with, and everybody was told to shut down for a period of time for 15 days and 30 days. You know, there were a few, not many, but said, we're not doing that. Well, that was not smart, and it was, I think, in a spirit of belligerence. But now we're months into this, and we're seeing this, as you said, discriminatory approach toward the church. And I think we have to rethink this and the positions that we hold as a result of where we stand today, what Scripture teaches, and what certain government officials are doing.
You're absolutely right, Tony. And the example that you cited from Acts is exactly what Peter said. We must obey God rather than man. And again, I think there is a theological argument to be made here that the government officials have no right to interfere in ecclesiastical matters in a way that undermines or disregards the God-given authority of pastors and churches. And again, this is what religious liberty is all about. This is why those of us here at FRC are so passionate about this, because government exists to protect the God-given rights of the people, and the most fundamental right is that freedom to worship, the freedom to believe what we want in terms of theology, and the freedom to live out our lives in accordance with those beliefs. And,
right.
And barring an extremely high bar that is equally applied across the board, which is frankly what we're not seeing right now, when the state tells churches they can't hold services, they can't gather for worship, they can't sing, they've crossed a line into the jurisdiction that God has explicitly given the church. And that's the point that we need to be underscoring right now, that God has not granted civil rulers authority over doctrine or religious practice. And all Americans should be able to get behind that. That is what the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment guarantees. But specifically as Christians, Tony, we just need to be clear in our thinking that the realm of the conscience, our faith, and how we live that out, how we practice, the government has absolutely no right to interfere with that in a way that is discriminatory. And I'm afraid that is what we're beginning to see in this case in Nevada that we've been highlighting is a great example of that.
Absolutely. And David, I think we have to underscore the fact that we do not secure our freedoms by saying, well, we have them. We're just not going to use them right now. We've got them. They're locked away. We secure our freedoms by using them. And sometimes that comes with resistance and opposition. And my message to pastors would be to prayerfully consider what the Lord would tell you to do. If you're in one of these states where there is discriminatory policies being put forth by those in authority. David, we're out of time. I want to thank you for joining us. And I know there's resources available for pastors and churches at the website, TonyPerkins.com, that you've put together. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tony.
And folks, thank you for being with us as well. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, you know that everything you can do when you've prayed, prepared, and taken your stand. By all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.